Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up, today's college student can just as easily be a working adult as a 19-year-old living in a dorm. Is the paradigm of higher education keeping up with the evolving needs of today's learners? Also this morning, to your health, lung cancer remains frequently misunderstood and often caught too late. But new biomarker testing is improving treatment options and providing new hope. And happening around town, you love rock and roll? You know Reg Routsen does. He's famous for his love of classic rock. And now he's leading a group bringing that great music to the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts later this year. And they have even bigger aspirations. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, July 15th, 2026. The American College of Sports Medicine has released their annual American Fitness Index. And for the ninth year in a row, Arlington, Virginia is ranked as America's fittest city. American College of Sports Medicine, American Fitness Index. They measure things like physical activity, number of parks, trails, obesity rates, chronic disease, and several other metrics, other indicators to compile this list. And Arlington, Virginia, number one. At number two, right across the Potomac from Arlington, Virginia, is Washington, D.C. on the list. That's almost unfair that they should have number one and number two spots. I mean, it's like Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Dallas, Fort Worth. It's basically one big city. But anyway, Washington's number two, Minneapolis, actually number three on the list. Seattle and Denver round out the top five. Cincinnati is the top Ohio city on the list, the fittest city in Cincinnati at number 27. Cleveland is 41st, Columbus is number 52, and Toledo is 81st. Now, Oklahoma City is at the bottom of the list, and I believe, again, they were last year as well. But keep in mind that the bottom of the list is number 100. So these are 100 cities. There's certainly more than 100 cities in the U.S. So when we say Oklahoma City is at the bottom of the list, they're still not too bad as number 100. So there are a lot of places that could be worse than Oklahoma City. But that's what they look at the top 100. So it's like Toledo being 81st. Yeah, it's near the bottom of the list, but it's, you know, we're only talking about 100 on the list. So just keep that in mind. Let's see here. We've got another list. We love lists. How about this one? This is the Allstate Insurance 2026 America's Best Drivers Report. Oh, boy. For the second year in a row, Brownsville, Texas has America's best drivers, according to Allstate. And this is the way they term that. Drivers in Brownsville average 14.99, nearly 15 years between collisions. If you had an accident in Brownsville yesterday, it would be another 15 years before you would statistically have another one. And the national average is 10.86 years. So well above the national average in Brownsville in terms of the amount of time between accidents. Boston ranked last among the 200 cities on this year on this list. Drivers there average just 3.76 years between accidents. So that's a 189% higher accident rate than the national average. Waco, Texas posted the biggest jump in the rankings year over year, climbing 40 spots from their ranking last year, while Detroit fell the steepest, dropping 38 places year over year. So they got 38 places worse in Detroit. And I don't know if you spend any time driving in Detroit, I'm not sure they could afford to fall 38 places. Their insurance rates are going up. As for the Ohio cities on this list, Akron is tops, 58th best overall, again, out of 200. Toledo is 69th, and then comes Cleveland, Cincinnati, and Columbus were with the worst drivers in the state of Ohio. Although, I'm looking at that and I'm thinking, I wonder, I mean, there are an awful lot more cars on the road in Columbus, a lot more opportunity to have an accident in Columbus than, say, Akron. I mean, it's not, Akron's not a small town by any means, but it's a heck of a lot smaller than Columbus is. So I'm wondering if that plays a part in it as well. The report draws from claims filed by Allstate Insurance customers between January of 2023 and December 2024. So the data is already a little old by the time it makes it onto the report, but interesting stuff nonetheless. Let's see, a couple of other Ohio. Oh, by the way, speaking of Ohio traffic, the Ohio State Highway Patrol is among the top finishers of this year's Best Looking Cruiser contest. This is a follow up. You remember the story from what a couple of weeks ago? Each year, the American Association of State Troopers has this contest, and state highway patrol offices from all across the country submit photos of their best-looking cruisers, and many of them are professional photographs that are taken in front of, you know, state landmarks, or in Ohio's case this year, kind of an America 250 theme. And this year, the Ohio State Highway Patrol landed at number 4 in the competition overall with over 17,000 votes. And that means that the Ohio cruiser photo will be featured in the American Association of State Troopers wall calendar for next year. By the way, the Florida State Patrol came in first place with over 52,000 votes. So Florida will be on the cover. But that's pretty cool. Pretty cool there. Kudos to the Ohio Highway Patrol. And one other Ohio story to pass along here this morning. The Ohio Secretary of State, Frank LaRose, is warning residents of some confusing voter registration mailers that apparently have gone out. And certainly this has been a hot topic politically over the past several years, election integrity and all of that. And, you know, voter registration, making sure that only the right people are registered to vote and people who shouldn't vote are not on the list. But Secretary LaRose says an out-of-state group has purchased addresses from data brokers, and they are sending out forms that look like they are coming from a county election office, but they are not. And some of the information is not up to date. They're being sent to residents who are already registered to vote, or people who aren't eligible, or even people who have passed away. The Secretary of State suggests checking with county election offices directly if you have voter registration questions. So I mention it. Just, it sounds to me like this is not about scamming the system or compromising the integrity of elections. It sounds to me like this is just a scam to get someone's personal information. So if one of these things lands in your mailbox, know that it most likely does not come from your local board of elections. So you want to be very skeptical on this. And a couple of other items here. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Won't be long now before we start talking about football season. And we're talking American football, not world football with a World Cup. I'm talking American football season right around the corner, and the holidays will be here before you know it. And here's a story combining both. If you are a fan of Bengals quarterback Joe Burrow, you could hang him on your tree this year, this holiday season. Hallmark has introduced the NFL Cincinnati Bengals Joe Burrow Football Legends Christmas tree ornament. It is the 32nd ornament in the Football Legends keepsake series from Hallmark, with past honorees including Joe Montana and Peyton Manning. So Joe Burrow in pretty good company there. The ornament is on sale now if you are a fan. Bengals fan, if you are a Christmas fan, you may want to pick that up. And lastly here, among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This is something to chew on. New research shows that millions of Americans are borrowing money or draining their savings to be able to afford to eat. This is according to a new report from the Urban Institute, a nonprofit think tank. Over 25% of working age adults who relied on credit cards to buy groceries were either unable to pay their balance in full or missed their minimum payment. In addition to that, 20% or about 20% of working age adults said that they dipped into long-term savings that weren't intended for everyday expenses at least once in the last 12 months to pay for groceries. The research, they say, highlights the financial strain that many households face as the cost of living rises. How is it possible that people are taking on debt or dipping into their savings, draining their savings, just to be able to afford to buy food? That is, by the way, yesterday, America's five biggest banks all reported record profits in the second quarter of the year, with JPMorgan Chase reporting the most profit, the highest profit ever for any bank in the history of American banking in the second quarter. Just to put that into a bit of perspective there. You can draw your own conclusions, just putting it out there, but something doesn't seem right in this equation. To me, I'm just putting that out there. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchak. Your WTOL 11 weather. Plenty of sunshine expected again today with a high in the 90s and a feels like temp in the hundreds. Partly cloudy tonight, low in the 70s. The number of cases caused by an intestinal parasite called cyclospora are on the rise in northwest Ohio.
The Wood County Health Department said it has confirmed 101 cases of cyclosporiasis. That number joins Lucas County, where health officials reported a total of 412 cases and 661 in northwest Ohio as a whole. In Michigan, officials reported there more than 2,000 cases. Cyclosporiasis is most commonly associated with fresh produce, and health officials encourage the public to practice safe food handling to prevent the illness.
ONN's Jeff Hogan reporting. Get more on our website. Seneca County Sheriff Fred Stevens is addressing what he calls misinformation circulating about a recent fatal deputy-involved shooting. The sheriff released a clip of the body cam footage that he says shows that the deputies did not have their guns drawn around the man's vehicle when they spoke with him, and that the deputies drew their guns only after the man put his vehicle into reverse and hit the guardrail and then drove his vehicle towards the deputies. Get more and see that clip of the body cam footage in this story on our website. People had the opportunity to tour Finley's historic former fire station at 401 North Main Street before the property is offered through a sealed bid process. We spoke with Finley Service Safety Director Rob Martin at one of the open houses, who told us the sale will include deed restrictions to preserve the historic aesthetic of the exterior of the building.
We're proud of this building, and we're proud of the service that the fire department served out of this building over the years. We're happy to give somebody the opportunity to bring life back into this building, maybe bring some of the historical value of it back with the aesthetics and things.
Sealed bids will be accepted until 2 p.m. on Thursday, August 6th. To get more of our conversation with Rob and see some pictures of the historic fire station and this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, you know, the college student of 2026 may look very little like what you would expect. Sure, you still have the traditional 19-year-old or so living in a dormitory, but today's learners are just as likely to be a working adult, a career changer, or an ambitious professional looking to broaden their skills in a fast-changing industry. And these days, aren't they all? Our next guest argues that the traditional higher education model was not built for these types of students, and colleges and universities must rethink what higher education can be. Dr. Antoinette Farmer-Thompson is president of Strayer University, which is a private for-profit online institution based in Washington, D.C. And when you look at these modern students, what do they actually need from higher education today?
Great, Chris. Thank you for having me. You know, you described it very well. These modern students have very busy lives, and so they want practical skills and clear pathways into fast-changing, high-demand industries, and they expect education to fit into their lives. And as you mentioned, Strayer's been doing that for over 134 years. Funny enough, we started by connecting education to career. And that's exactly where we are. I would say the other thing that's so pertinent today is that these students need higher education to deliver a learning continuum that takes them from baseline AI literacy to advanced agentic capability, meaning they can design, direct, and deploy AI systems. Those are the realities for today's modern student.
You mentioned AI, and there is so much talk about AI. Frankly, a lot of people worried about what AI may mean for their career, worried that they may be left behind by artificial intelligence and the deployment of something that they don't fully understand. How can higher education better prepare individuals for the realities of AI, especially in an environment where we don't really know exactly what's going to happen next with this emerging technology?
That is so true. But I will tell you, Chris, that number one, students have a very valid concern. I was looking at Manpower Group 2026 Global Talent Barometer Report. Mouthful, but here's what it said. 45% of global workers say they're already regularly using AI at work, and that's a 13% increase from 2025. So like you said, this is moving quickly. And what it tells us is that AI fluency is not a luxury credential. It's a new literacy. And those who have it versus those who don't will really create a major gap and will be what we call the defining economic inequality factor for the next decade. So higher education must do a couple things. One, they must implement AI workforce-based applications in all of their academic programs. AI is and should be throughout every industry. And I'll give you just a couple of examples. We introduce students to AI in what's called the gen ed classes. So the beginning, Chris, of your journey, you come in, you're in a science class, and you're learning how AI can be used to drive data analysis in real world case studies. And then as you continue your journey, your degree, you have applied AI level. So we have AI concentrations in IT, business, healthcare, MBA programs, and you're working on workforce integrated projects, real employer challenges. And then should you continue going to the master's level, and a lot of people are surprised that they love this stuff. We launched one of the first of its kind working adult masters of agentic AI. And this is where we're training students to be architects and to manage and govern AI systems. So once you lean into it, it becomes easier. But higher education must make these pathways available throughout every single program.
Is higher education, by and large, moving quickly enough on this?
I will say it this way. I evaluate higher education by looking at, number one, do they have a proven track record in working with industries and really keeping a pulse on the skills that are needed, not only for today, but tomorrow. And the one thing about Strayer University is we're tech forward. We've been online for years. We were one of the first adopters and adapters of online education. Mm-hmm. And so some of the things we're able to do is offer these programs online. And what you find, like we had our Strayer student team win the Division II National Security Agency Codebreaker Challenge. You've got to lean into these things. We've acquired Media Design School out of Auckland, New Zealand. It's a creative technology school, 3D animation and visual effects. And then we've launched a master's in fine arts. And then finally, you must have employer partnerships. Strayer has more than 500 employer partnerships where we're understanding the exact skills employers are demanding. So I have a tendency to evaluate higher education and our efforts against those three or four factors.
And for the working adults that we're speaking about and speaking to those non-traditional students thinking about going back to school, how do they identify the Institute of Higher Learning that is that is a fit for what they are looking for in an education today, especially, again, surrounding so much of an artificial intelligence track?
Very good question. So one, does the institution have opportunities where they have worked with working adults and career changers? Accessibility, affordability, flexibility, things being online, education fitting their lives. And then number two, it's really important that the institution is not only helping them keep pace with the advances in AI, but helping them to drive adoption for the workforce using real life workforce examples. And then finally, it can't just be AI fluency. It has to be scaffolding learning all the way through the mastery so that people are not only using AI to transform their workforce, but to transform their own lives and eventually their community.
Again, Dr. Antoinette Farmer-Thompson is president of Strayer University, talking about the need for higher education to evolve in the modern age to better cater to or better adapt to the needs of these non-traditional students that are making up more and more of the student body. Dr. Farmer-Thompson, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Lung cancer remains the leading cause of death in the U.S., and yet it is still often misunderstood and all too frequently caught too late. According to the Lung Cancer Foundation of America, more than 250,000 cases being diagnosed this year, or about one every 2 minutes, but only about 27% of those cases are diagnosed in their most treatable early stage. The good news is that lung cancer treatment is entering a more personalized era thanks to advancements like PD-L1 biomarker testing. Johns Hopkins oncologist Dr. Julie Bramer is with us this morning, along with lung cancer patient and patient advocate Colette Smith. Dr. Bramer, let me start with you. In layman's terms, what is PD-L1 and how has this testing changed lung cancer treatment?
So PD-L1 is a protein on the cell surface, and cancer cells use this protein in order to shield themselves from the immune system, kind of like an invisibility cloak. And this PD-L1 testing has opened the door for us to use immunotherapy for the treatment of lung cancer.
And Colette, tell us about your experience, your diagnosis, and the importance of knowing your biomarker in your situation.
Yes, of course. I am an 11-year lung cancer survivor. And through a CT scan, which is an image of the chest, my lung cancer was discovered. And I am proof that early detection and through screening does save lives. Through the process, I got a biomarker testing done, and my doctors were able to develop a treatment plan which involved removing my upper left lung. I am being scanned annually, and I have no evidence of disease.
Mm. Now, Dr. Bramer, I understand that the treatment options, the treatment path, in many cases, depends on the PD-L1 level. Is that right? What should patients realistically expect with respect to the treatment based on that PD-L1 level?
So for patients who've been diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer, so lung cancer that's spread outside of the chest,
mm-hmm.
if they have PD-L1 high levels on the cancer biopsy, then immunotherapy by itself can be used, even without chemotherapy, to control the cancer and potentially control it for a very long time, even out to 5 years, at which time we typically would say, if we can't see any evidence of cancer, that they could be cured of their cancer. Now, if patients' cancers have PD-L1 low to the point where we cannot detect it in their biopsy, immunotherapy can still benefit them. However, we have to combine immunotherapy with chemotherapy. Mm. Chemotherapy to directly attack the cancer, and then immunotherapy to get the immune system to also treat the cancer as well. Now, that these patients too can benefit even beyond 5 years, and potentially in those cases, we can, in some patients, say that they're cured as well.
So, Colette, what would you tell patients who are facing a diagnosis and wondering what to do next, what to ask next? What would your advice be?
I would tell that patient, number one, lung cancer is not a death sentence. Find a care team that you can partner with, and ask for biomarker testing. However, Dr. Bramer, as the subject matter expert, can elaborate a little more.
Yeah,
patients, when they're sitting in front of their doctors, and what questions should they ask? One is, what stage is their cancer? What type of lung cancer do you have? And then, what biomarkers have been tested on my cancer biopsy? One, we look at mutations or gene changes in the cancer, as well as PD-L1. I think we need that information in order to develop the best personalized treatment for that patient at that point. We also want them to ask about clinical trials. Is clinical trials right for me at this time? Because all of the tests and the treatments that we just talked about were all developed through clinical trials. And so we want to continue to improve therapy, and clinical trials really give us hope that we can.
Absolutely. And we've talked about that before. So I'm glad that you brought that up. It is so very important. And Colette, from on a personal level, what would be your message to someone who is facing a diagnosis? Because as we mentioned, the numbers are not, the raw numbers are not necessarily encouraging. There is good news, but it is not always obvious. So on a personal level, what would your message be to someone, one of these, you know, quarter million individuals who will get a diagnosis this year?
There is hope. Science around lung cancer is evolving every day. Face your fears, and most importantly, find a support group that understands your diagnosis. I have a similar support group. It's 30 women who are all lung cancer survivors.
Lung cancer patient advocate Colette Smith with us, along with Johns Hopkins oncologist Dr. Julie Bramer. Where do we get more information on all of, like we always say when we talk about anything regarding a health topic, the best source of information is going to be your personal doctor. But that being said, where can we direct folks for more kind of general information?
Patients, And others who are interested may go to lcsamerica.org. It's a great source of information.
Thank you both for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the broken news this morning, the story of an 82-year-old woman in North Carolina who survived 9 days stuck in her bathtub after falling last month. Joan Rivett, or Rivet, is R-I-V-E-T, I believe it's Rivett. Joan Rivett injured her back when she fell and couldn't climb out. And you think, well, why didn't she call someone? Well, her phone was locked behind the bathroom door. And even if the phone was in the bathroom, she probably couldn't have gotten it anyway because she couldn't get out of her bathtub. Now, Joan doesn't have any family that lives nearby. And obviously she doesn't work. She's 82 years old, so she doesn't have a whole lot of daily obligations. So no one noticed that anything was wrong. It was actually her brother in Georgia who was unable to reach her by phone, who eventually called her neighbors and asked them to check on her. She said she survived by using her foot to turn on the faucet and splashing water onto her face. She was hospitalized for dehydration and bed sores and is now recovering at a rehab facility. So thank goodness she's going to be okay. After she gets out of rehab, she says she's going to move to Georgia to live with her family. That's probably a good idea. By the way, the story goes on to say that her cat, Phoebe, also survived. So that's good news all the way around. I think Phoebe will probably be glad that she's going to move to be closer to family as well. Elsewhere in the broken news from the international file, although this is good advice wherever you live, should you happen to find yourself in possession of a hand grenade, probably a good idea not to take it to your local police station. That is the message from Constable Michael Fathy of the Ontario Provincial Police in Canada after a concerned citizen brought a World War II-era grenade to a police station in Ottawa in an effort to dispose of it. Here, you take care of this. Ottawa Provincial Police would like to remind the public that if you find such an item, please do not transport it to your local police station. This could obviously prove extremely dangerous to yourself and others. Again, it does have a happy ending. The story, upon the grenade's arrival at the station, explosive experts were called and the device was kept outside until members of a nearby military base arrived to safely take it away. Can you imagine being on duty? The police department office, somebody walks in with a grenade. Hey, how about you take that outside? Let's just go outside with this. Just leave it alone. Could have ended much, much worse. And finally, in the broken news this morning, in Hialeah, Florida, a woman accused of chaining her child to a fence at her great-grandmother's home is now facing charges. 34-year-old Yashira Maldonado was arrested over the weekend after she allegedly chained her 13-year-old daughter to a fence and left. So not exactly mom of the year here. I don't think she's going to win any awards. She told police that, yes, what she did was probably wrong, but she wanted a break. Well, I have a feeling she's going to get a break. She's not going to have to worry about taking care of her daughter for a long, long time at this point. There you go. I think the state will make sure they step in and take care of that. That is today's Broken News Report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. Wow. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Hi, I'm Josie. My daughter turns 5 today. Blow out the candles. I'm also an Ohio State Highway Patrol trooper. When you move over and slow down, you're not only giving me room to work, you're making sure I can get home to celebrate with my daughter.
Roadside workers have lives and families, but when they're on the job, they put it all on the line to protect and serve us. Let's all give them room to work. When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Where are America's top grill masters? A new Talker Research survey of 5,000 Americans for National Grilling Month in July finds that residents of Wyoming grill the most. Wyoming. They average 17 days per year grilling. That is four above the national average. The study found 47% of Americans identify as regular grillers. And do this on a regular basis, led by Oregon at 61%, Michigan at 59%, and New Hampshire at 58%. Conversely, Hawaii, Mississippi, and Vermont residents are the ones that grill the least, which was a bit of a surprise. Maybe not Hawaii, okay, but Mississippi? Grilling the least? That was a surprise to me. Nearly half of Americans, 49% to be exact, find grilling to be intimidating. And 32% say they get especially nervous cooking chicken. I want to make sure that they do that. And you know, there's good reason. You want to make sure that you do that right. Undercooked chicken is not good. But as a result of this grill intimidation, 57% say that they pretty much stick to grilling safer foods like hot dogs and hamburgers because they're too nervous about cooking other meats properly. But despite their experiences with that kind of grill intimidation, 84% of Americans in the survey say they would grill more often if they had the opportunity to. Which, I don't know, how much of an opportunity do you need? You know, 5 minutes, you fire up the grill, you slap on a burger or a dog or a brat or whatever. But anyway, they say 84% of Americans would grill more if they had more opportunities to. 47% say that food just tastes better when it comes off the grill. I'd have to agree. 48% say that the food is the number one thing that brings people together at a summer gathering. More so than the music, the conversation, even just being outdoors is not enough if you're not grilling as well. And by the way, the biggest grilling sins, they ask about the biggest no-nos. 32% said touching someone else's grill is the biggest sin. That's the biggest no-no. 31% said skipping the resting period for meat. You got to let that rest right after you take it off the grill. Very, very important. And 30% said the biggest no-no is constantly lifting the lid. And I have to admit that I struggle with that. I have that urge to just lift the lid and check on it all the time. They say you shouldn't do that. So I guess I'm not a grill master myself. Well, it wasn't that long ago. We were just talking with Heather Clough at the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts about their new main stage series season that has been just announced, and it is a terrific series. But what you'll notice is missing are music concerts. It's highly focused on Broadway and things like that. Well, most folks know in the community Reg Routsen as a member of the Reunion Band and obviously a great lover of all things rock and roll. And so he and a couple of friends got together and said, well, we need to bring more concerts to town. And so that's exactly what they're doing. Reg, thanks very much for taking the time. This is kind of a new venture for you, something that you have not done before. You played, obviously, but now you are shifting into the role of promoter, if you will.
Yes, Chris, I had my first experience, if you remember, was about 2 years ago when we put on Finley Rocks the 60s.
Yeah.
And I got a taste of what it takes to bring musicians together, all those sorts of things. And so that was a little bit of experience. This is a little bit more adventurous, I guess you would say, in terms of trying to bring a show. But the idea is that myself, Don Templin, and Jeff Fort have banded together in concert with the with Marathon Center, not in opposition, but in concert with them, to promote some rock and roll shows that you had mentioned. And so the three of us have banded together. So we are the promoters for a show in October involving a Tom Petty tribute band and a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young tribute band on October 24th at the Marathon Center.
And you were mentioning, we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, you've gone to a lot of these shows and thinking, you know, we really need to bring some of this to Findlay. That was kind of the genesis for this, right?
Yes. My wife and some friends, we travel pretty much the Midwest, like a weekend kind of a thing or an overnight sort of thing, and hit most of the venues that produce and show a lot of these sorts of acts. As we talked, many of them are unfortunately tribute bands now because of the unfortunate passing of people like Tom Petty and many of the members of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But and some are good and some are bad. And this is a particular show that I saw in Chicago about a year ago and was just overwhelmed by how good they were, how much energy that they was, and how the crowd reacted. There were well over 900 people that were there. And I thought, well, this is the sort of thing I think that people in Findlay would appreciate. And so we came back and we kicked it around between the three of us. So we've decided, in concert with Marathon, we're going to promote this show. So the three of us are the financial obligors, as it were, for whatever happens at this particular show. We hope to make money, not so that we can have profits ourselves, but we want to roll back into other shows and contribute it to charities in Findlay, whatever might be appropriate. That's our goal. So it's not a money-making enterprise, as it were. It's more like, I guess you'd call it a nonprofit in a way.
Yeah. And so your hope is that this is not just a one-off.
Yes. I mean, we'd like to see some synergy or some energy develop. And I don't know if you attended the show we did a couple years ago, but we sold it out.
Yeah. Yeah. So clearly the demand is there and people will show up. And what has been, I'm curious in doing this, because this is a new venture for you, what has been the most surprising and the most challenging part of putting all of this together in this type of role that you haven't really done before?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you might imagine, I've presided over a lot of cases and I've helped mediate a lot of cases, you know, negotiate and settle matters when parties are disputing. This is a little bit different. This is really negotiating with promoters of bands, negotiating with the Marathon Center, because we have to pay them, obviously, you know, for the use of the facility. Mm-hmm. And a lot more, I would say, many more complications and details would probably be the best way to say that I wasn't really prepared for. One example, and you've heard the whole thing about the green M&Ms, right?
Yes, in the green room for the or the dressing rooms for the artists. Yeah,
each of these bands has a quote hospitality writer,
right?
And it's not that extreme, but just those sorts of details that you know you have to sort of look at, because if you sign a contract, you promise you're going to do your best to comply with it. So I guess the level of detail that's involved in the back and forth, picking a date, we didn't know if this was going to happen in October, then it was going to happen. So the sort of just the back and forth issues has been fascinating.
You were never that picky with a reunion band demanding like only green M&Ms in the nothing like that, right?
No, Chris, we usually had to pay to perform at these places.
But again, and you know, the other part of this, and I want to go back and you know, focus on this a little bit, because I think this is really cool. The idea is, you said you're not looking to make money. In fact, you know, what you bring in, hopefully you're hoping to kind of funnel into more shows and more opportunities to bring some of these artists in.
Yes, that's our goal. In a perfect world, we would pretty much sell it out. We would have then some profit surplus, whatever you might want to call it, at the end of the show, because we pay the acts, we pay Marathon, and hopefully we have something there. Then we look at what we have, and we're already looking. I mean, we're hoping for success because we're already looking at something we might want to do in 2027. I know that Don Templin is very enamored of some of these really good yacht rock tribute bands that travel around.
Yep.
That might be something Finley might want to see.
So people can really help out two ways. If this sounds like something that you would like to, you know, promote within Finley and get more of these acts in, more of these great bands and tribute bands and such. Obviously, getting tickets to the show, it's coming up Saturday, October 24th, I believe is the date, right? And tickets are on sale now?
Yes, they've been on sale for about a week. I think we're close to 200 tickets so far that have sold.
Tickets are on sale, and you can get those at the Marathon Center website. Again, Saturday, October 24th is the date. So that's number one. And I guess number two, when folks see you on the street, just let you know what kind of stuff that you would like to see in the future.
Yeah, interesting you would mention that. I've had a lot of opinions given to me about who should be next. So well, that's good.
Yeah,
that's very good.
Absolutely. So we look forward to it. We've got a link on our webpage for more information about the Tom Petty, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Joni Mitchell tribute coming in late October to the Marathon Center. And again, Reg Routson helping to make it happen. We appreciate you taking some time, and certainly best of luck with this endeavor.
And Chris, thanks so much for listening to me and having me on the show so people understand that there's more to this than simply a money-making enterprise. I appreciate it.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Once again, remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage, and that is goodmornings.net. Also, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. Coming up tomorrow morning on the program, Team USA's Round of 16 exit from the World Cup left many pointing the finger at our youth development program as the reason America lags behind in the global game. But the problem with youth sports in the U.S. runs much deeper. We'll take a closer look. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.